Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, a thought experiment on whether taking out a mortgage for your investing future would actually make sense. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, bud.
Hey, what's going on, Ross?
It's a bright day in your prison cell over there. The sun is vicious.
It's always a bright day. We're recording early today, and the morning sun comes in through that window, so you get extra backlit Dan today.
It was more aggressive today than I'm even used to. I feel like I comment on it every single time we record our show, but today I was like, oh, wow, it's even more aggressive than normal.
Yeah, we just turned on the video and you started chuckling. Nice reminder for people who aren't watching us on YouTube that you can check us out there if you want to see what we're talking about.
That is true. Yeah, I can't tell if people like seeing us on YouTube or not. It doesn't seem to get a ton of engagement, but we were told we're missing it if we don't do that. So that's okay. Wherever you prefer to listen, we are platform agnostic. We don't care. As long as you're tuning in, we appreciate it.
Yeah, we're happy to have all of you, regardless on whether you want to see us or hear us. I don't know why anyone would want to see us, but it's
no, there's no visual element to this show, and the system we record in doesn't let us like screen share or anything. So yeah, it's just looking at our faces while we talk to each other.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so Dan, what's going on in your life, bud? What do you have to share with our listeners that isn't directly related to our topic? Because I feel like we're going to take a different angle at it, by the way, but we're going to rehash something that we've kind of picked at a couple different times on our show. But anything actually going on with you?
The biggest thing in life is that the brewery celebrated our 6th anniversary of being open last week, which was really exciting. We had a great turnout. We advertised that there would be live music, which was not something we apparently prepared for. So I got to play with my band, which was a lot of fun. My favorite moment was people like to shout out requests. I'm sure you're very familiar as a DJ of people coming up and making requests. And I had a very funny moment where someone came up to me and requested Dave Matthews Band, who I famously dislike.
You dislike Dave Matthews?
I dislike them. I have a list of bands that I acknowledge are great, but I do not like. And Dave Matthews might be on the top of that list. And I got a lot of crap when I notified everyone of my feelings.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, so Dave Matthews' drummer, Carter Beauford, is probably my favorite drum set drummer of all time. I grew up playing drums. I'm still a very casual drummer at this point, but he is an absolutely incredible drummer. But Dave Matthews gets a lot of hate. They actually even joked about this recently where they said, I think we only have 35,000 fans, but the good news is they all show up to every show. So they do have really, really intense fans, but they get a lot of smoke for reasons that I'm not completely sure of.
And they have all the hallmarks of a band that I would like, which is what surprises me the most because they're incredible musicians. They jam. I love bands that jam and don't put on the same show every night. And they definitely fall into that category. You know, they're fun. They'll mix things up a lot.
Is it because they're from Virginia, Dan? Is that your Maryland side just lashing out at a Virginia band?
No, usually that would be a bonus as well, that they have local roots in some fashion. I think it's because my first Dave Matthews album was Every Day. I think that was the name of it, which is a very, very boring album. And also they're a much better live band than a recorded band. The same would be said about the Grateful Dead or Fish. Any of those jam bands put on a great show. So maybe the answer is I just need to go see them live. But until then, they are on my list of great bands that I don't love.
Fair enough. All right. We got to get off of this because this is a personal finance show, and we can't do an entire episode about Dave Matthews, even though I
thought you were going to say this was a personal attack on you and we need to switch subjects.
I mean, no, I don't take any personal offense if you don't like the music I like. I think there's plenty of things I like that are not in your wheelhouse and vice versa. So I don't think that bothers me. I do think you're wrong, but that's okay. I don't need to make my PB&J the same way as you. I don't need to listen to Dave Matthews the same way as you. That's
I think a lot of people will think I'm wrong. Let's transition to an article that may be right or wrong as well.
Yeah, so I enjoyed the article, and I also was like really fearing that we were going to rehash the exact same show. So we have to take a different line at this, but this came out. The Economist posted this just a couple days ago on the 19th of February. And the headline was, should you put all of your savings into stocks? As market roars, old argument returns, is the subheading. And basically, I don't want to talk about whether or not you should put your whole portfolio into stocks. We talked about that with the hedge fund manager recently, but they brought up a couple points that I thought were interesting. One of the arguments was stocks are maybe not the optimal portfolio. It's not the most risk-adjusted portfolio, that some combination of diversifying assets is going to create a more efficient path. That's a very investor inside baseball sort of term, whether your portfolio is efficient or not. All that means is, are you getting the best return for the amount of risk? So my first question to you, Dan, do real people care about that at all? Do retail investors, as the average person walking the street, actually give a hoot if their portfolio is risk-adjusted properly? Do they care if they didn't beat the market, if they took less risk, if they beat the risk-adjusted benchmark?
I don't think people care. So if you're walking down the street, you're not thinking about whether your portfolio is properly risk-adjusted. I think the important thing there is that people will act on it. So you don't care about it until you find that you have taken too much risk or too little risk, and then you're going to make a change. I feel like that's always what we as planners or advisors are optimizing for, is what is the chance that someone is going to get uncomfortable and shift out into something that is inappropriate for them or more dangerous for them. Whereas those people aren't thinking that way. They're like, I want to be in the thing that's going to make the most money for me.
So in your mind, the risk is decision risk. It's behavioral.
Correct. Yeah.
I agree, right? Like that's the only ride that is too aggressive is the one you can't stick with.
Exactly.
And that's why when like an article like this comes out and says, could you or should you be 100% stocks? We're basically like, yeah, if you're not a baby about it and if you're not close to needing the money. That's generally our argument is, yes, we believe you can and possibly should be 100% stocks if you've managed your temperament and you've managed your timeline.
Right, which is so funny in this article, which is very easy to digest. It's short. It's not very technical. But the different people making recommendations are almost speaking different languages, because the guy at the end, who I believe is he a hedge fund manager?
It was like an AQR guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, no, you got to think about the risk-adjusted portfolio to optimize. And the other guys are like, you should lever up this thing because the expected long-term return is going to be way better if you're aggressive than if you have some balanced account.
Correct. And he even said you should go into the more optimal portfolio, that risk-adjusted portfolio, but then to get back to your boosted returns number, you should lever it and you should borrow money to create that. Now, the top comment on this, and this was on Instagram, the top comment was the funniest thing, and it was basically like, is the Economist trying to crash the market? is the Economist trying to ruin the stock market by telling people not only could or should you be 100% stocks, but here's the good news, go out and borrow some money and let's really ramp this thing up. That sounds like silly information from the Economist coming after a pretty strong market year and a strong start to the market this year. That's not normally when you want to go lever up. But the reason we're talking about it is it brought back an idea that I had many years ago. And I don't think you remembered that we had ever talked about this, but I found it interesting. What were you going to say?
I was just going to mention how silly it sounds to lever up on a portfolio like that. Yet in different contexts, it's something we do every day when we buy houses, more than 100% leverage. We bring 5 to 20% to the table to buy an asset that is much larger than we brought. And, you know, that comes with its own risks as well, except that we have a longer time to evaluate it, which I think is a nice transition into what you were about to say, that a conversation we had almost a decade ago.
Yeah. Like I had this idea in like 2015, 2016, somewhere in that time frame. And the idea was basically, what if you could get a mortgage for your portfolio? Right. The thing that younger investors are constantly burdened by is when they have the most opportunity in terms of time, right? Like if you're coming out of school in your 20s and you're not going to retire until 60, you presumably have an almost 40-year long investing time horizon. That's an incredible asset. The problem is most of you in your 20s don't have any money. That's it. Like that is the problem. So what could we create? Is there a financial product we could create that allows you to overcome that? Could there be a mortgage for a portfolio? Now, in the era that I thought about this for the first time, we were in lower interest rate environment than we are today. So at a 7% interest rate, I don't know that I can make the math make sense. But I do want to talk about this just as a concept of like, would this be valuable? And so I put some numbers to it this morning.
Nice.
So that we could play with
prep work.
Yeah. Do you know who you're talking to, Dan? Come on now. I'm Mr. Prep Work. As Dan cracks up. I normally show up to this show and I'm like, what are we talking about? Okay. So let's presume, and I'm just going to use some round numbers here, because I think that's just going to make it helpful. So let's assume that somebody could save $1,000 a month over the course of their lifetime. So they never increase the contribution. We just want to completely isolate this $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year. Now, again, I know that might be a difficult number to hit when you're 22 and right out of school, might be an incredibly easy number to hit when you're at your peak earning years. There's a lot that goes into that. But if you invested $12,000 a year at 7% over 30 years. When I say 7%, that's the compounding return rate. So I'm trying to give a modest expectations for stocks over a 30-year period. What you'd have at the end of that is $1.2 million. Not bad. You'd be a millionaire. $1,000 a month for 30 years at a reasonable stock return gets you to millionaire status. Let's reverse it. If I was willing to take out a loan today that I pay at $1,000 a month, so $12,000 a year, and I did this on a 4% interest rate. Again, I'm trying to back into where I was when I originally came up with the idea. At 4%, 30-year loan, $12,000 a year, that would allow me to borrow $215,000. So, okay, that makes sense. So then we flip the equation one last time. Hopefully I haven't lost everybody in this math. If I invested $215,000 today over that same 30 years, same 7% return, I end up with $1.6 million. So having front-loaded the exact same amount of savings, I add $400,000 of value. And that's regardless of the interest, right? Like I'm still going to pay interest, but the extra compounding, the fact that I was able to invest that large sum early, the additional compounding gets me to $400,000 ahead of where I would have been had I just put $1,000 a month in and let it compound. Same return rate, same investment in the stock market. Why is that not a product we have?
I love the idea. I think there are clearly wrinkles that need to be explored because, right, had we created that in 2015, people probably would have been hungry for that 4% rate of return and then very quickly been sorry that they were locked into a, you know, fixed maturity at 4% had you issued that.
But you're talking about the bank would be upset that they had that on their books.
Right. So I wonder if there would be provisions that would be like a callable, you know what I mean? Like how would the bank protect themselves from issuing that kind of debt? Although, you know, I'm sure there's going to be secondary markets and things that could account for that.
Yeah, I think the way that the bank would protect themselves is that this has to be issued by the institution that holds the investments. And yep. The agreement is just that if you miss a payment, they're going to take money out of your principal.
They're going to repo your account.
They're going to exactly. But not all of it. Like, this is basically an extended time period fixed rate margin loan. And it would give you access to the asset. That's what would have to happen. It would be like a portfolio line of credit. Now, most of those are variable rate loans. So that this, like when they suggest that, the actual mechanisms for how people borrow against stocks completely invalidate the theory for me, right? Like if you're going to take a super efficient 60-40 portfolio and then lever it up to the return that you want, you can't do that math because it's not a fixed rate product. I mean, I guess you can, but you can do the math, but you have to build in some variability there. But this to me would be a really interesting way to flip economics on its head. It's just the risk of people not continuing to pay into it or making obligations that they can't commit to. And like, I mean, there's a lot of behavioral stuff. How does this compare to somebody that has a sudden wealth event, right? Because I think most of us, the path for the average saver is you start small, you hope that you make your biggest mistakes when it's a small pool of money, right? Like if you're going to be bad at this, which most of us are, by the way, we are instinctively bad at this. You want to be bad early and you want to learn and then stop being bad.
Yeah.
When you look at a sudden wealth event, like a lottery winner, or you see this a lot with professional athletes where they have this sudden influx of wealth and they haven't had time to make mistakes yet, many of them lose everything. Does this introduce that risk, or do you put guardrails on the product where it's like, look, you can eject and take whatever your net asset value is, but we are not going to let you buy and sell and tinker with this. This is a contract to buy an index fund.
That was the other thing I was going to mention is, do you control what the investment goes into? Because over a 30-year period, we expect markets to perform well. But if you have someone going and YOLOing all their proceeds into ApeCoin or whatever, you know, maybe that's not what you want.
No, 100%. This only makes sense in my brain on a hyper diversified, you know, either all US or all world portfolio that, yeah, you're not giving them the keys to trade. Right. I think that's critical.
You're buying a basket of some kind.
That's it. And it needs to be predefined. It needs to be as vanilla as possible. Hopefully in a way that, you know, there's no way you can let people go out and buy whatever they want inside this wrapper. Because people blow their portfolios up all the time doing silly stuff.
For sure.
That's not new. That will happen forever. I think that the instrument has to be designed to protect against that.
I was looking off to the side while you were talking because what you mentioned reminded me of a great part of a book I read by, I think it was Monish Pabrai, the Dundo Investor, where he was talking about making mistakes early. And that's almost what you should be doing. If you're going to take a big risk, do it when you have the least amount to lose. Not directly related to what we were talking about, but I'll put a plug in there for the book, which I think is fantastic.
I mean, yeah, no, I completely believe that. And I made horrific personal financial choices for the first 2 years of my career. And I have been nervous about returning to that place in my life since then, not because I'm actively close to it, but it's made me a more conservative person in terms of how I deal with my own money. And that's a good thing. I'm in a much better place because I screwed up early.
Right. If you're going to screw up, that's when you should do it. If you're looking to take a risk, I mean, I would take smart, calculated risks. Like if you're going to start a business or something, you know, do it before you've saved.
What dum-dums would do that, Dan?
Right, exactly. You know, do it before you're going to sacrifice everything to pursue that. You know, give yourself the benefit of time and the opportunity to rebuild if you have a miss.
All right, Dan, here's the crux of this for me. Are we just repackaging the should you pay for a house in cash question versus invest the proceeds and take a mortgage? Is that what we just did? If you had the money, and we framed it for somebody that doesn't necessarily have the money, so it allows them to front load their investing. But at its core, I think what we're really talking about is if you had access to cheap capital and you have access to the stock market, would you make that trade-off? Do you want the equity in your house or do you want the equity in the stock market?
I think that's exactly what we've done now that you mention it. And I think at least we're consistent. Our stance has been consistent, whether you frame it one way or another, right?
But the interest rate is huge. I think the current environment makes this a much more difficult question, because I don't know that I'm willing to pay a certain 7% against a possible 7%. And it could be could be a possible 10, right? So it's still, there could be a delta to the upside. We still think there's upside for being a stock investor. And more importantly, the loan is going to continue to decrease in value, where the stock investment is going to continue to compound. So even though you're paying the same rate of return, if you basically stretch the timeline further and further and further, the compounding does more for you. So I still don't know that there's no argument there.
Right.
But it's certainly harder to say, would you pay 7 to get 7? You're like, yeah, probably not. I'll just sit in the bank and earn my 5.
One other thing that I thought was interesting about the article is framing our understanding of market returns over time. I thought this was fascinating because it's talking about how when we look at historical returns, we're often going back to like the late 1800s as a starting point when we have the best data that's available on markets, which sounds like a long time. And from that point, you can make like thousands of different rolling periods of return that cover the same 140 years. But when we're talking about retirement, we're talking about potentially 40 years for some people. And think of what 40 years is relative to the 140-year period we evaluated. Like 140 years is almost very insignificant when we put it in that context. So our understanding of how markets have behaved in the past might not be real. Like, we have a very small snapshot in time, and in 40 years, markets may look totally different than we understand today. I thought that was a really interesting point they made, just because of how we evaluate market averages. Like, maybe we need to reframe all of that.
And most of the modern stock market, we tend to go back to like 1920, right? I mean, that's normally the period we're looking at, is not even as far back as you're saying. Like, we talk about the Great Depression, we're like, well, that's as bad as it's ever going to get. Right?
Right.
That's functionally our current idea of it. Like, mathematically, we know that it could be worse, but we're like, yeah, well, it won't be worse than that. And we talk about 08 as kind of this really out of left field sort of, you know, once in a century sort of event. But that's really not necessarily true. It is a short timeline that we're thinking about in the history perspective. That's tough to even wrap your mind around, quite frankly. Because if you expand that really far, you can get to like, what the hell do I do? Right? Like, you can absolutely stretch that into absolute paralysis. Like, I think at least focusing on what's likely or what's been happening for the last 100 years, you're like, yeah, okay, I can at least make a decision off of that. I feel like if you go too far into those edge cases, while they are possible, you can kind of get to an extreme where you're like, well, yeah, there's nothing that makes sense and is historically proven enough that you could completely and always defend it.
So this is in part why I like the way Morgan Housel thinks, and this might be a line of his, but reading around your subject rather than in it, I think helps you become like a better investor, for example, because you understand other things that have happened historically and how people might behave and react according to that, rather than just diving deep into a data set where you have like a fixed outlook on investing or life even. So for people looking to learn and improve themselves, I think it's valuable to go just beyond the standard investment books and look at other things too. History in particular, I think is fascinating.
Are you just trying to pat yourself on the back for all your Civil War reading recently, Dan?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I'm doing. I'm going to make some road trips soon. But honest to God, like, there are a lot of economic lessons from the Civil War. One day we're going to do that on this show. I promise.
Every time that idea has come up, we end up rolling our eyes at ourselves and we're like, we're not doing that show. We cannot do that podcast.
We're going to lose the rest of our listeners.
Amazing. So what do you think about this? If you were given access to a mortgage for the stock market early in your career, if you had to commit to that savings rate, would you have even taken that offer? Do you think that that would have been something that appeals to you, the ability to borrow that money and put the time in a very healthy manner on your side, but by signing up for an obligation to fund. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. Obviously, the product doesn't exist. We're not a bank. We're not offering this. It's not something you can get today. So I think it's just an exercise mentally, but hopefully you found it to be an interesting one. If you made it to this part in the show, I suspect you did find it interesting. And if not, we'll try again next week. We appreciate you tuning in. Check your balances at outlook.com is the email address for the show. We appreciate you all. Have a good one.